We move on to Indigenous affairs, I think, and come back to... There's one more question on asylum seekers and a number from the audience as well, but I think we'll cover... move into Indigenous affairs and make sure that we've covered well the four main issues that were proposed for tonight, and then move into returning to some of these issues. Andrew, you've got a question on Indigenous disadvantage.
Yep. This is firstly directed to the Greens, but hoped it might open up this issue more broadly as well. The churches all welcomed the bipartisan apology to the Stolen Generations, which was a feature of the last Parliament. And we looked forward to a greater priority being given to Indigenous policy. But given that the Indigenous constituency and therefore its political influence is so small... And yet the issues of Indigenous disadvantage and dispossession are such a moral stain on our history as a nation. What priority should be given to those policy issues, particularly the question of reparations, land rights and improved health outcomes, education and housing outcomes?
Libby.
Thanks, Andrew. Yes, it's a fundamental moral question, so it should... actual population numbers and the amount of pressure Indigenous organisations can exert on the political process should be irrelevant. It is what we need to do to again build a compassionate society based on reconciliation and respect for difference. The Greens are committed to signing a treaty and having that treaty recognised in the Constitution. We're also committed to... I know we've got limited time, but there's something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 royal commissions and inquiries that have been held going back to 1991 and the Aboriginal deaths in custody, in which governments of both persuasions have failed to enact the recommendations. In other words, we've had inquiry after inquiry. We know what we need to do to help build the Indigenous community so that their standard of living is the same as the mainstream Australians, and to respect their particular needs and to overcome the legacy of disadvantage. But that's 7 royal commissions and inquiries dating back 19 years, and we just haven't had the political will to follow through on them. So that's the first step, and that includes that issue of reparations, particularly for the Stolen Generations and for the Little Children, a Sacred Report, both of which talk about the need for reparations. But just to give one more example, one of the scandals in Queensland is the stolen and unpaid wages going, you know, right back to the early 20th century when the Queensland government... It was a legacy of the 20th century. It was governments of all persuasions lost the files showing where the Aboriginal wages had been retained by the government. So they admitted this, and it was good to see that the Bligh government and Beattie government both said they would do something about this. But what did they do? It was an appalling and insulting offer that was made, and many Indigenous people didn't accept it. And when there was this body of money left over, because Indigenous people were insulted by what the government had offered... I'll get it later, Brett... The Queensland Minister said, well, we'll put it into Aboriginal education. Now, why should Aboriginal people have their unpaid wages put into education when the rest of us get our education for free? It was just insulting. So the key points in our policy are that Indigenous Australians are entitled to exactly the same housing, health and education services as the mainstream. There shouldn't be any distinguishing or special treatment or conditions put upon that. It is the responsibility of government to make sure all Australians get those services. And I mean, the fact that we haven't done it means that the argument for sovereignty on the Aboriginal side is really strong. We've had more than 200 years in which we've claimed this is, you know, white Australian British territory and then white Australian territory, and yet government still can't administer remote Australia where large numbers of Aboriginal people lived. Well, to me that says maybe your legal thinking is a bit wrong there, and if you really want to prove that, then maybe you should get out there and start delivering services on the ground and stop blaming Aboriginal people when they live in overcrowded houses or don't have the same education levels as the rest of Australia.
Andrew, you'd hope that might open up a broader conversation. Yeah, I'm going to ask 60 seconds from the other three people on the general question, because it is not a big vote winner. It's not a big public front policy for electioneering about what we will do about Indigenous disadvantage, at least not that I've heard in this campaign. But I would like 60 seconds of mention about what does your party believe is the appropriate level of priority and attention to be paid to this issue? Thanks, Wendy.
There's no doubt that we owe the Aboriginal people an enormous amount, particularly financially, because we, and when I say we, I'm talking white Australia, we came in and we just camped on their land and took it. So there's none of us who haven't benefited from that. And so what I would really love to see, and this is not a Family First policy, but it is something that we are talking about wanting to try and get out there, because Family First is a real grassroots party, so we can get out and really speak to people. I would like every single church in Queensland to be the ones to actually do something, because do you know what? The governments can't do it, because they've shown us over and over again they're not doing anything and they can't do it. We were all really happy to hear the sorry, but there's been nothing happened since the sorry. So if every single church in Queensland took it on their plates to actually do something to reach out to the Aboriginal community and to actually support an Aboriginal mission or support Rotary or whoever's doing something in the Aboriginal communities, or support the Aboriginal people in the way that they would want us to, and ask them. Do you know, there's no one who can actually speak for their Aboriginal people, because they all have different elders and they all have different ways that they govern. So we need to talk to them. And if every church in Queensland, you imagine across every denomination, actually led the way and did something about it, boy, that'd be great.
Thanks, Wendy. Brett.
Thanks. Again, welfare alone isn't the key. I mean, you people, Noel Pearson, indeed Wayne Swan has said, you know, the welfare drip has been killing Aboriginal people. If I had to nominate two keys to it, it's opportunity and education. And I agree, actually, with Libby about the quality of schools. It's a fact that Indigenous and non-Indigenous kids going to school in, let's say, central Brisbane, have quite similar results, quite similar. Yet as the schools become more remote, the difference between Aboriginal kids and non-Indigenous and Indigenous kids and non-Indigenous kids becomes greater and greater and greater. In other words, the problem isn't indigeneity, the problem is the quality of the education.
Claire.
As we said when we came to government, it's a high priority for the Labor government. We said that with the apology. We put that there. It's disappointing that Wendy believes nothing has happened since the apology. I think if you have a look at the record, there has been unprecedented action in the last 3 years. Whether, in fact, it has been effective in every case, I cannot make that guarantee. But in terms of where this government has put priority in health, in education, in housing, the numbers speak for themselves. The numbers also say we haven't concluded it and we haven't done enough. But it doesn't help when actually the work that has been done is not seen. And in terms of what I can put forward is what has been 3 years of action led by a minister who truly cares in this area and a high priority in cabinet decisions. And in fact, there is not a single cabinet decision which does the impact on the Aboriginal community is not taken into account. So in terms of process, of course we can do more. Of course we must do more. And that will happen. But in terms of reparation, I'll put it on the table. At this stage, the Labor Party does not support individual reparation for Aboriginal people. We've said consistently that we think that the best way to handle it is to look at significant funding, and when I say significant, I mean significant funding, into education, health, housing, community development, and that's what our policy is. And I know that that is not universally accepted, but we as a Labor Party have never had a policy of individual reparation. So in terms of the future, I'm happy to look at individual issues. But in the policy area, it has been a core area. One of the very important areas, though, is where we actually at the national level have Aboriginal voices. And in Parliament now we don't at the federal level, and that is an issue, though not one single voice, not one person can represent a whole culture. So I think when we have in the past had individuals in Parliament, there's been an undue expectation that they will be able to work miracles. And I think certainly Senator Bonner and then Senator Ridgway both suffered, I think, from an expectation that they alone could make a change. But it is a shame in our political system that but we've talked about it ourselves many times, that we don't have Aboriginal people being elected into our parliaments, and that's an issue for all of us to look at. One of the questions, and it's further down the track, and I don't know who is going to own it, is about the Congress and how that will operate. And I think that leads into there as well. The Congress is relatively new. We actually believe as a government that it has a core role in working with parliaments, not just federal parliament, and community and organisations to ensure that there is a point of consultation and discussion and engagement, because since ATSIC was wiped out, there has not been such a body. And ATSIC, with all its failings, actually did have a point of contact. So I think it leads on to that area. But to say nothing has happened is incorrect. To say not enough has happened is also a correct statement.
Thanks, Claire. You're talking about the National Congress of Australian First Peoples.
Yes.
Correct.
Congress,
indeed, just in case people weren't aware. Camilla, one more question at the moment on this question of Indigenous Affairs, please.
Well, I wanted to ask whether all of the candidates support the continuation of the intervention in the Northern Territory as it presently operates, and if not, what would they do instead to improve the safety, health and, in particular, education of Indigenous children on remote communities? And added to that, make sure that there is due consultation with these communities.
So the intervention, Brett, I might give that to you first, seeing as it happened under the Howard government, and then invite each of the candidates a brief response.
Yeah, sure, I'll be quick. Yes, Camilla, the intervention was necessary, and we think, and indeed should remain. Something had to be done to break the cycle of violence and alcohol and substance abuse. And let's face it, perhaps the most fundamental human right is the right to, personal safety or non-molestation. And only when you can guarantee that on Aboriginal communities can you make any sort of progress. And I agree with Claire. You said before there have been strides under the past government and the current government in relation to Indigenous affairs. There is, in fact, a closing of the gap. It might be too slow, but it's not all bad. And health, Indigenous health relative to non-Indigenous health is getting better. So I don't want to be totally negative. People say, oh, it's all bad. It isn't all bad.
So the intervention continues?
Yes, the intervention continues.
Okay. Claire, invite you next, and then invite Libby and Wendy.
I think it's really sad that we're still calling it the intervention. The intervention happened. We didn't agree with the way it happened, but in terms of the focus it put onto the issues, I think that in itself was a good thing. The intervention process occurred, and our government has come in, and we are working with what came out of that. So the programs and the policies in terms of focusing on health, focusing on education, ensuring that people have the right to speak out, having access to services on communities which were never there. We are strongly supporting those policies. The most controversial aspect is welfare quarantining, and I can talk all night on that subject and you don't want me to. But in terms of the process, this government actually brought forward legislation which looked at the issue of welfare quarantining. We did three things. First of all, we made sure that it was not the Racial Discrimination Act was not removed from the process, and we restored the Racial Discrimination Act without limitation into the legislation. Secondly, we said that welfare quarantining, which for it's false, is not the only aspect of what happened with the intervention, but when you talk with people, it seems that's the only thing they know about, the fact that there was a change to the way Centrelink payments were received by people who lived in certain areas. We changed that prescription, that it was a locationally based change, to a legislation that was coming into effect on the 1st of July 2010, but the election process has kind of overcome that. Looking at the process of welfare quarantining will be a model for how people who are on long-term payments will actually interact with Centrelink. And there's lots of controversy about that. And we could talk about the consultation process, which was extensive. It was not perfect. A lot of people don't like what's happening, but there was a genuine attempt to have consultation. We have made that now a process that is part of the Centrelink system. The good thing about that is for the very first time, and I worked for many years in the Department of Social Security, there will be a genuine data collection for the impact of the process. It is a very sad fact that lots of people talk about the way welfare interrelates with people, but there's very limited data anywhere that shows the impact on people, their livelihoods, their ability to access work, all those things, pay bills. I'm sorry I'm taking a long time on this, but it's a core aspect of the issue that should not be called intervention. It should be called ongoing process for interaction as opposed to the intervention, because you're already labelling it before you're looking at what's happening on the ground. This is no longer, the welfare quarantining is no longer an issue only for Aboriginal people. I take the point that in the first process, many Aboriginal people will be caught up in it, because what's happening is it's being introduced in the Northern Territory first, the whole of the Northern Territory, not just prescribed areas, to make sure that the system is operational and able to be used. So it's a very important issue. It is not an easy one, and I draw all your attention to the Senate inquiry on this legislation. And if it's something you care to read, please read the 270 pages of that report, because I helped write it. And I was the chair of that committee, so it's a very sensitive issue. We stand by the point that this is a way forward, but it has to be done with people, not to people, and that's where I come again. Having government separated from community will always have people removing themselves from the discussion. The whole focus of the way welfare quarantining is supposed to work is it interacts between the person and others, so that that's you're not right. left alone and in isolation. So if you're going to ask a question about intervention, you're going to get a long answer.
You're going to get a big answer. That's a complicated question. Libby.
You can talk more about welfare quarantining at the next forum.
If.
If the government had listened to advice from those many royal commissions and inquiries, some of which, such as the Women's Inquiry, Aboriginal Women's Report into Domestic Violence in Queensland, they would have come up with a very different solution. There wouldn't have been the Northern Territory intervention. There wouldn't have been social welfare quarantining. There would have been realistic programs on the ground. And I was a bit disappointed earlier, Bruce, when you made this allusion. Brett, sorry. I was about to tell the story about Bruce Trevorrow. That's why I got name wrong. Sorry. After I spoke about, you know, the need for matching health and education and housing, that the assumption was, that we're talking about welfare. Absolutely not. The government should have gone into the Northern Territory and trained their Indigenous people longing for traineeships and apprenticeships. They want to build their own homes. They want the skills. The difficulty is they don't necessarily want to leave their families and their communities to do the really difficult training, which is generally only available in capital cities, and they don't have the resources in those capital cities to live on, and it's really daunting. And it's daunting for white students, and it's daunting for Aboriginal students. So you could have done a reconstruction process from the ground up in which you trained people to build sustainable communities. And believe me, the many much advice that government has been given by Indigenous women about the problems of domestic violence have not involved a heavy-handed government approach. They do want community policing and proper nighttime policing. That's another essential that they have asked for, but they do not necessarily want punitive approaches to alcohol and to substance abuse. It's all there. We've got the Indigenous advice, and it's so sad to hear both sides of major parties resorting to patronising responses to Aboriginal people like, oh, no, we couldn't give individual reparations, or we couldn't possibly have an elected Indigenous Congress of First Peoples. I just find it astonishing, and which was why I was thinking about Bruce Trevorrow. And what the government is saying when it says, no, we couldn't possibly have individual reparations, is you, as a community, you're going to have to get to the courts and fight one by one and go through the pain of that legal process. And Bruce Trevorrow was one lucky Indigenous man who survived the Indigenous process, and the court said, my God, this story of this man stolen as a one-year-old child by a hospital is appalling. He must be paid reparations. And sadly, Bruce died within 6 months of that landmark judgment, and of course it was tragic that in that 6 months he knew that the South Australian government was taking it back to the court to try and dispute the decision. And that's essentially the callous attitude that the government is taking when they say, oh, we'll make the decisions for you. Of course we'll listen to you, so maybe. We'll let you talk to us and maybe we'll listen to you. But, you know, you can write those really long reports with all your personal experience in them, but we don't have to act on the recommendations. Well, 19 years is enough of the reports and inquiries. Listen to the Indigenous community. The answers are all coming from them.
Thanks, Libby. Wendy.
We spotted the intervention when it happened, but by all means we need to protect our Australian children, and that includes white and Indigenous Australians. So we have to stop the cycle of poverty and the dependency on government money, and that is only going to happen when governments and communities work together. I think we've got to cooperate with the Indigenous leaders themselves, the community leaders. They've got the track record of knowing what's best for their communities. It's not just one leader, it's all of them. We've got to listen to them, and the children must be a priority because the children are the future, and they must be the priority, and they must be protected. Different ways of learning need to be also implemented. Sometimes when you move out into the Indigenous communities, they don't want to learn or want to do assignments even the same way as other schools might want to do. And so we've got to look at different ways of education. We've got to think laterally, and we've got to think as we've got to ask them and talk to the community leaders, talk to people.
Thanks, Wendy.